Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org. Well, I would like to welcome you all to this afternoon's panel discussion on Paths to Zero and other topics related to the nonproliferation of nuclear weapons. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the Commonwealth Club. I apologize for not being here earlier for the presentation of the award. Secretary Schultz knows the Commonwealth Club is a busy organization, and we're hosting Governor Schwarzenegger up at the Fairmont Hotel talking about his second-year anniversary of his climate change legislation and so on. So I've dashed over here, but I'm very happy to be with some longtime colleagues and friends. And, of course, I'd like to offer congratulations to Professor Jean Lowe for his award. And also to say how happy I am to be associated with the Federation of American Scientists. I've had many friends who've been who worked with FAS and served on the board over the years, particularly Ruth Adams, the recently departed, a couple of years ago, editor of the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists, and we all miss Ruth a great deal, but it's a fine organization. I was just involved in the last couple of weeks in a review by a major philanthropic foundation here in this area, which is interested in getting into the field of nonproliferation. And they drew in a group of experts to talk with them about what tack they might take in this area. It was an interesting discussion, I have to say somewhat daunting, because anywhere they would focus, there are so many areas in which they could focus at this point. We've essentially seen a time over the last decade and more when we our progress towards the goal of reductions of nuclear weapons has been extremely slow. While we've done some good things in the area of export controls and interdiction of weapons of mass destruction on the high seas and reached some agreements with other countries, in most other areas, we have really slid backwards. Particularly, I note the fact that we have no follow-on agreement with Russia to the START II agreement, which is soon to expire. We also have seen, of course, up and down in our negotiations with North Korea. Currently seems to be a down period with the North Koreans looking to restart activity at the Yongbyon complex and the situation with Iran and so on. So sitting as I was at a table at a foundation trying to figure out what to do most effectively in this area, the answer was basically everything. And we are at a critical juncture today on the cusp of a new presidency in the United States. Therefore, this is a terrific moment to discuss what can be done and what should be done. And, of course, into this environment of little productive work over the past dozen years or so and the opportunities of a new administration, we've had the proposal, dramatic proposal by the Four Horsemen, as they're referred to, Secretary Schultz, Secretary Perry, Senator Nunn, Secretary Kissinger, which has stimulated a discussion nationwide about the prospects for dramatic reductions in nuclear weapons. And many people and organizations have tried to flesh out what these four individuals have proposed, ways to start, individual actions to be taken to take us down that path towards zero nuclear weapons. So today we have not only the originator of that proposal with us, but a terrific panel of discussants to talk about paths to zero. Let me briefly introduce them from left to right. My longtime colleague, Harold Smith. I believe your affiliation is now the Goldman School, but
at Berkeley.
at Berkeley, former Defense Department official, and in fact, my very close and esteemed colleague at the Department of Defense. We had many adventures together in an effort to dismantle nuclear weapons in the former Soviet Union.
People in the Defense Department talk about adventures. Come on.
Adventures in a very positive sense. And some things that the Defense Department had not been involved in the past. And
that's
I think
true.
We, Harold and those of us involved, broke some new pathways there. To his right, Joe Cirincione, my boss at Plowshares Fund, the president of Plowshares Fund, and with a long background in the field of nonproliferation, the author of a number of books in that field, and a very articulate spokesperson, one of the most articulate spokesperson in the Washington environment now and nationwide on nonproliferation. You know Professor Jean Lo because he was introduced before, and I'll also turn to the gentleman on my right who certainly needs little or no introduction, former Secretary of State George Shultz, who we value here as a participant in the Commonwealth Club, a leader in the Commonwealth Club in helping us to focus attention on important issues, be they defense, California issues, energy. He's such a tremendous leader and valued statesman of the Bay Area as well as the nation and the world. And then to my far right is Ivan Ulrich, Vice President of the Strategic Security Program at the Federation of American Scientists and deeply involved in the Federation's Paths to Zero project. So with that very brief introduction, I'd just like to pose an initial question to the panel, which is, let's say it is January 21st, a new president of either party is in the White House. What would you recommend the new president's first action be in the area of nonproliferation?
Well, I hope he will follow through on his commitment during the campaign to work on this issue. Both candidates have spoken very powerfully in favor of seeking a world free of nuclear weapons. And one of the things that my colleagues and I have been doing is to try to prepare the way and to be able to say to a new president, if you decide to undertake this, here are the kinds of steps that you need to be thinking about. And a lot of them are technical and they're difficult. But here are a set of papers that have been written by outstanding professional people, Raymond included, that can start the process. And we can vouch for the fact that all the people who wrote these papers, if you ask them to come in and work and help, they'll do it. They'll already roll up their sleeves, and there's a lot of work to do. This is not a pie-in-the-sky effort. This is hard work. Step by step, you got to do it. And we also can say to a new president, there are a lot of people who have signed on to this effort that are known around the country. Something like three-quarters or so of the living former secretaries of defense, secretaries of state, and national security advisors are publicly committed to support. So if you get ready to go forward, a lot of people will stand up behind you and say, let's go. And I might say that the spirit is a little different than you might think, because people come to Sam or Henry or me or Bill or any of us and they say, gee, in this era when everything is so partisan and nasty, isn't it so nice to have something that's bipartisan? Mm-hmm. We all say, you know, it's not bipartisan. It's nonpartisan. This is a subject. We've got to think about this on its merits and deal with it on its merits. It just doesn't lend itself to a Republican position and a Democratic position. It's a subject that we need to advance, and that's the spirit. So I would hope that if a new president undertakes it, both candidates having come forward, the one who loses will be willing to stand up and say, I support this effort, so that we can move it forward on a bipartisan basis. I've also been impressed with the fact that we can tell a new president there's a lot of interest abroad. And I know when we finished a conference last October at the Hoover Institution that Raymond gave a wonderful paper at, we thought to ourselves, we should have a conference in some other country and get people from other countries and see what they should do. And out of the clear blue sky, the government of Norway said, if you'll bring your act to Oslo, we'd like to put on a conference. So we went. And they got 29 countries there, including all the countries that have nuclear weapons, including Israel. And it was a riveting conference. Not that everybody was saying, let's go and everything, but it was serious and people were exploring things. I might say the issue that Raymond brought up just kept coming up all the time. These are weapons-oriented type people. And they have the nuclear fuel cycle on their minds because everyone can see, as you said, the potential importance of nuclear power plants. But if we don't get control of the nuclear fuel cycle in some effective way, we're asking for trouble. So that's on everybody's minds. But at any rate, there's a lot of resonance out there in the international community. So it'll be important to go about this carefully, because it can't be a U.S. Program that we try to get people to sign on to. We've got to get it forward as a global initiative. And I think that if there is one branch of academic work that's essentially international, it's science. There's no such thing as national physics. Mm-hmm. So in the effort to put it forward as kind of a global enterprise, I think we will certainly be wanting to work very closely with the scientific people who know something about all these different difficult subjects if we're going to get it off the ground. So I hope that that we can move forward, and it's very exciting, and we're trying to be careful and do it right and not get associated with people who are for unilateral disarmament, all sorts of crazy. There are a lot of crazy people out there. We're not with them. It's not just serious effort. We're going to be looking after our national security interests all the time. But if there's one real threat to the national security of the United States, it's a nuclear weapon, however it's delivered, by a ballistic missile or a cruise missile or in a suitcase or whatever it is. It's devastating. So we're better off, and mankind is better off, if we don't have these weapons around.
Harold and then Joe.
Dr. Duffy and I had the great privilege of working directly with the Russians starting in 1993 to help them, through the Nunn-Lugar bill, dismantle their nuclear arsenal. And think back over what that meant. And all of us in this room had, well, not all of us, most of us had lived under the threat of nuclear annihilation for a half century. And then suddenly, people like Gloria and myself had the opportunity to disarm the very enemy who had threatened to destroy us for decades. It was a wonderfully motivating and very, very successful effort. Now Gloria has asked the question, what would we advise the next president to do? And when we look at the scene today, we have a resurgent Russia, cash-rich Russia, not always admirable Russia, but there are two things we want from Russia in the near term, and one of them, of course, is control of nuclear weapons, of which our two countries have the overwhelming preponderance. It seems only natural, then, that either president would call upon the diplomatic corps for the just the right sort of diplomat If Secretary Shultz is up to it, we should send George. But if he doesn't want to go, there are others. And we should have a truly plenipotentiary ambassador to sit down with the Russians and discuss with them what we need to do together, setting aside the things that are keeping us apart, whether it's membership for NATO by Georgia or Ukraine or the European missile defense. Put those on the other table. They are not as important, as Secretary Shultz said, as the nuclear weapon used against either country. And the two countries I know, and Dr. Duffy knows from personal experience, can work very effectively together to really make enormous headway in controlling nuclear weapons, not only of our own, but of other nations through various scientific enterprises, one of which we might talk about later, called nuclear forensics. So my advice to President O'Kane or McBama is send an ambassador of Secretary Shultz's caliber and agree to discuss those topics that are of immediate and enormous concern to both countries.
Joe?
Let me just add to that. In great part because of the work that Secretary Shultz has done, there is now a broad bipartisan and nonpartisan consensus among the U.S. security elite that this agenda has got to be a top priority for the next president of the United States. And Secretary Shultz and his colleagues have opened up an enormous political space that make it safe for the president to go where previous presidents might have hesitated. And it's because of their work that both Senator Obama and Senator McCain have embraced the idea of leading a campaign for nuclear disarmament. Senator McCain made his pledge in the city of Los Angeles in March 26th. But how exactly do you do that? How do you fulfill that plan? And I think on January 21st, after the inaugural parties are over and the president goes into the Oval Office for the first time and he takes a look at his inbox, he's going to have serious reservations about having accepted the job. He might start regretting that he won that election, because there's going to be a pile of problems that all say urgent on them, including several pressing nuclear problems. You have got to deal with Iran. You have got to deal with North Korea. You have got to deal with the expiration of the START agreement, or else we will lose our ability to verify Russian nuclear weapons in their disposal. And as the president tackles these, and I agree with Harold that he should, Hal, that he should take as a priority starting a process of significant reductions in U.S. and Russian arsenals. And as he starts a program, as Senator Obama has said he would do, to accelerate our programs to secure and eliminate materials that terrorists could get for nuclear weapons, and as he starts a process for a bipartisan support for the ratification of the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty, as both candidates have said they would do, the two most important things I would recommend to the president is that you not do it piecemeal, that this has got to be part of a comprehensive plan, a comprehensive vision where you understand where you're going, that it takes place in the context of moving step by step towards a world free of nuclear weapons. So present that vision. Number two, enlist the American people in this effort. Senator Kerry has recommended that the president give a speech to the American public in his first 100 days in office on this topic. I think that's absolutely critical. The president should include this as part of his inaugural address, embrace this as one of the themes of his administration, enlist the American people, and sustain public support for this as only a president can do.
It's always tempting in these to come up with your list of things to check off, and there certainly are things that we can talk about, taking weapons off of alert or announcing major reductions, and I think that we can debate about which of those would have the greatest effect. I think one of the first things the president should do would be to take
weapons off alert as a concrete expression of reducing nuclear tensions. But I want to vote in on Joe's point that we need to make it clear that we have a different attitude toward nuclear weapons. We've all seen the cartoons where the cartoon character runs off the edge of the cliff, and then he hangs in midair, looking at the audience, and he's suspended in midair until he looks down and he realizes there's nothing under him, and only then does he fall. Okay, and we have been carried forward for two decades after the end of the Cold War with basically Cold War light thinking. And we're just now at the stage, in part because of this remarkable op-ed in the Wall Street Journal, where the country as a whole is looking down and we realize, oh, it's not there anymore. And we're starting into free fall, that the sort of the logical underpinning of, you know, our nuclear doctrine, we're realizing it doesn't have the foundation that we thought it did. We're approaching a tipping point where people are starting to realize, and I think this is not going to be a gradual process, but people are going to make this transition from thinking that overall, all things considered, nuclear weapons contribute to our security, okay, to a point where they think, no, overall, all things added up, now nuclear weapons contribute more to my insecurity, my danger, than they do to my security. And that's going to be sort of a rapid transition from one phase to another. And the president can bring that about, and I think there's an enormous amount of latent public support. One of the things that we've seen is that, frankly, nuclear weapons have not been on the public radar scope to any great extent since the end of the Cold War. Almost by default, nuclear doctrine has fallen to a tiny little nuclear priesthood, mostly nuclear weapons are not popular among the military. It's among a small group of civilians. These people are not being second-guessed by the Congress, and so in a sense, they don't have adult supervision. And we have developed a nuclear doctrine that I think that most people in the public, if they knew what U.S. nuclear doctrine would be, they would be frightened and appalled. And the president should step forward and say, no, we're going to have a no-first-use policy. We're going to use them only to retaliate against nuclear attack. This is what nuclear weapons are all about. This is the extremely constrained requirements we're going to place on them. A great deal of what we then think we need for nuclear weapons, enormously high yields, being able to launch on a moment's notice, having them mounted on missiles that can reach their targets in just a few moments, all of that will fall away because with an explicit statement of very limited missions, none of those requirements are there, and then Wile E. Coyote or whomever will finally fall.
All right, so imagining that president's in basket with all those urgent items on the 21st of January, what's going to bring this item to the top of the basket? We don't have the type of public concern about the issue that we had, say, in the 80s. We have not had a dramatic event, even though the Al-Qaeda attacks on the U.S. have certainly been connected to some degree to the potential that there could be a terrorist attack with a nuclear weapon. What's going to bring that item up above the economic crisis and all of the other things in that in-basket?
Let me start, and I would say there's three categories of nuclear issues the president will confront. There's the must-do list, and these are driven by external events. They're beyond the president's control. They're coming in. Action is required. Iran will be one of those. The collapse of the nuclear deal with North Korea will be one of those. Budget issues. How much he's inheriting a budget, he's going to have to mark up. How much am I going to spend to sustain the nuclear complex? Or how much am I going to spend for missile defense? Things he has to take action on. Then there's the will-do list, the things that both candidates have promised to do that will be on the list. Start a process for comprehensive test ban treaty. Start a process of reductions with the Russians. That'll be there, driven internally by the candidate's, now president's, own agenda. And then there's the should-do list, things that the president will have to do in order to accomplish the things on that other list, such as the ones I suggested, have a comprehensive policy, stop playing nuclear whack-a-mole, thinking we can deal with this one state at a time, one problem at a time, given an inaugural plug for the campaign. And that relies on us. That's where civil society comes in. That's where the media comes in. That's where Secretary Shultz and his efforts comes in, creating the tools and the incentive to encourage the president to go in this direction, to make the president realize it's safe to go here. You've got public support to do this. You have expert support. And if you do this, you will reap political rewards. You'll be popular for doing this. And so for me, that's what I think I'm going to be doing next year, is working on that part, backing up, backfilling the rows that Secretary Shultz has already plowed.
Other comments on that question? Getting it to the top of the in-basket?
Well, I think both candidates have said that this is something they support. And so really the calculus is that once you're in office, it isn't, at least, I don't know how to phrase this, because the implication is that the president can do more than one thing at a time, but I want this to be nonpartisan. So you can do more than one thing at a time. He has to make some effort to get this ball rolling. The question that he will have in part is he going to get public support? But also, it might be that sometimes you look at the status quo and you think, well, nobody supports that, but that's only because you haven't stirred the pot yet. Once you poke the status quo, it'll rise up and fight you back. So the question is he going to make the calculation that there is this latent support in the nation for people who want to have lots and lots of nuclear weapons and a robust nuclear policy doctrine? And I think that he would calculate, no, there isn't. And so what's the downside risk? What kind of troubles is he going to create for himself? So I think it's not going to be difficult to convince him to get the ball rolling and find good people that can carry this forward. There's not going to be a fight.
Harold.
First of all, I think Secretary Shultz has already answered the question. I think the new president, should call for an Oslo-like conference with all the nations and see if we can restart what the Secretary mentioned a moment ago. I also wanted to comment on the description of the four editorialists as the four horsemen and remind you that only one of the four horsemen was a football player.
Different four horsemen. Biblical, in this case. Other comments on that?
We've always found a real interaction, as we've talked about this, between the vision of a world free of nuclear weapons and the steps you need to take. If you just talk about the steps, they don't seem to have drive. If you just talk about the vision, it seems impossible. But if you talk about them both, there's a clear interaction, because the vision says, well, how are you going to get there? The steps say that there's reality to the vision, and it's an interactive process. So I think a president, part of his job is to be inspirational and to lift people up and say, here's the vision. And we all have this vision. Now, how are we going to get there? Well, we've got to do this, and we've got to do this, and we've got to do this, and rally people like that.
So this is the Federation of American Scientists, and we have, I'm sure, many scientists in the room. And I'd like to pose the question of what scientists can and should be doing. So there have been an interesting range of things that scientists have done over the years in this area. I mentioned the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists, the clarion call coming from the Manhattan Project to look carefully and oppose some of the uses of nuclear energy that were created from the Manhattan Project, the pugwash movement. I've been intrigued over the years to watch student pugwash, which has been administering an oath among science students, undergraduates and graduate students, a sort of a Hippocratic oath for scientists to use science for positive purposes benefiting humanity and so on. There are other efforts underway, some foundations like the Civilian R&D Foundation, which are employing weapons scientists to do civilian work and so on. But speaking, most of you here, as scientists, what's the role? You mentioned Nuclear Forensics Herald. What can the scientific community do to advance this cause?
I'll just answer that very briefly. Nuclear forensics is something that developed with the Manhattan Project and has continued in great measure. But either in detecting illicit fissile material before a nuclear explosion takes place, or detecting, picking up the particles, the debris from a nuclear explosion through radiochemistry and other techniques, one can discern where that fissile material came from, truly forensics in the detective sense. But to make the step, you have to know what the data looks like in the country that made the fissile material in the first place. To put it differently, it does no good to take fingerprints if the FBI does not have a bank of fingerprints to compare it against. Now, the step I want to take here in following up on Pathways to Peace is that if the United States and Russia decided to form a nuclear forensics team, and if a nuclear detonation took place, and this team were ready to go and had the combined data banks, think of the stability that that gives. It means that the United States and Russia jointly say that this material did not come from the U.S. or from Russia. Those of you who read carefully the literature, we have some data on what North Korean fissile material looks like. In other words, scientists in this particular narrow field of science, and there are many, many others, really could work bilaterally and hopefully multilaterally to put together what amounts to fingerprints of nuclear material. That's good not only in prosecuting a crime, but I think in deterring the criminal in the first place. If we had the data, let's say on the Korean weapons in complete detail, would the North Koreans really want to give that material to a terrorist, knowing that this Russian-U.S. team could trace the material back to them? And that's only one example. Dr. Zhenlao has done marvelous things in different fields, which really shows that scientists can contribute in a very unique, nonpartisan way.
Let me pick up on that and give, first of all, a general answer, or reiterate a general answer, which is that there's a lot of hard work to be done, as Secretary Schultz pointed out. And it is both an obligation but also an opportunity for the scientific community to come behind, backing up leaders like the Secretaries of State and of Defense who have stood up for these notions and say, here are some concrete steps that really are technically feasible. We just heard of one arena with this nuclear forensics, which we should emphasize, this is being exercised in real time, right now. There are materials that are interdicted in unstable parts of the world, nuclear materials that are studied, and I'm sorry to say that keep our national laboratories well exercised in these technologies, because it's a dangerous world out there with those materials floating around, so to speak. Of course, they're practicing for an application we hope never to see, which would be the post-detonation use of nuclear forensics. But that's one example. Another one was alluded to very briefly, and I do want to come back to it, because I think now there's quite a broad consensus in the technical scientific community that has looked at this, and that is the U.S. ratification and leadership in the bringing into force the Nuclear Test Ban Treaty, Comprehensive Nuclear Test Ban Treaty. For the U.S., there have been questions, as would be the case for any nuclear weapons state, of our own deterrent and how our understanding of our deterrent influences policy and vice versa. And in fact, the past decade has been a remarkable success story of the management of our arsenal, our deterrent. As long as we have national policy to have a nuclear arsenal, we need to handle it responsibly, safely, securely. And that, by and large, we've made great advances in those areas and understanding how well we're doing. Separately, though, we have to be able to verify a treaty. And again, it's a natural question that people have asked. How well can you verify such a treaty? And indeed, now the international organization that is charged with the verification of such a treaty is just bringing that system, that international monitoring system, into reality. It's almost completed. And of course, 10 years ago, when it didn't exist, reasonable people could ask, will it be up to the challenge? And we know it is. We know it is for at least two reasons. One is that one can use that system. It has been used, and of course, it was very successfully used to analyze the North Korean test. And so it was not planned this way, but in fact, it's been tested by a real event. But there's another way that it's tested, which is that there are hundreds of academic instruments, seismometers and tsunami observations and the like, that complement the international treaty monitoring system. They're independent. And quite frankly, it's graduate students and researchers and so on around the world that can help validate if something happens that isn't picked up by the international system and is picked up by the student or the researcher working late at night and over the weekends, we'll know about that. And vice versa, if the international monitoring system comes up with a fallacious and invalid result, it will be corrected. It will be noted by those independent observers. So there's a real symbiosis here between the basic scientific community and those elements of the scientific community charged within the U.S. and also internationally to provide official verification for treaties. That's very healthy. Those are but two examples. And so I'd come back and say it's up to the scientific community, among others, to work with our colleagues in policy to come up with those concrete, specific steps that can back up that broader vision, operating under that broader banner of the vision, motivating us to make specific, concrete forward steps.
I just want to say that I agree that the many people think that the ratification of the comprehensive test ban treaty will be the biggest single thing that we could do early on next administration, and that will have an enormous amount of technical expertise will be required, because that's going to be a debate that's going to, whatever your politics, a lot of it's going to be couched as though it's a technical debate. Okay. But so if I get to choose number two, since you got number one, I think that another place where scientists can contribute a great deal is in the analysis of the international fuel cycle. Yeah. We're going to have, I don't know if we'll have a nuclear renaissance and how much expansion we'll have of nuclear power, but clearly there's going to be a continuation of expansion of nuclear power. There is inevitably an overlap between nuclear power technology, whether it's enriching uranium, and then many countries now are extracting plutonium from a used reactor fuel, both of which are usable as nuclear weapons. We have to get that under control and to have real practical scheme for providing people with the benefits of nuclear power, although those are themselves controversial, without the risks of nuclear weapons.
Mr. Secretary, any comment on scientists' contributions?
At this conference in Oslo that I mentioned, it was clear among all these other countries that there was a certain skepticism about whether the United States, with all of the nuclear arsenal that we had, would really go forward. And there was, in a sense, a feeling that the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty is a test. If we can't ratify that, then where are we? Sort of attitude. I have made myself a little bit more knowledgeable. Sometimes it's dangerous to have a layman come to know anything, but I've tried to figure out what's involved in the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty, and obviously, as Raymond said, being able to verify whether it's a test or not is part of it. That seems to be in pretty good shape as far as I can make out. But the certification of the stockpile is the other essential ingredient. And I have taken myself over to Livermore and Los Alamos, and I've talked to people, and I've tried to understand it as best I can understand it. And the problem has been described to me, the weapon is a chemistry experiment, and it's changing. I didn't know. And there's a mock-up weapon that's cut open over at Livermore, and they tell you about this material and that material. And so somebody has to understand that. And the only people that can understand it are scientists who are trained to do that. And I think one of the things I would tell a president to do right away is, for goodness sakes, let's fund science adequately. And let's fund these labs. If we don't have a stream of talented scientists coming into those labs, they're not going to be able to do that job. They're laying people off at the labs right now, today. That's not the atmosphere in which you're going to attract bright young people to come. So we've got work to do, and we should get on it right away, I think. At this Laszlo conference, back on your point, they asked me to give what they call a keynote address, so I thought of what to say. And I labeled my remarks the Age of Diplomacy. And I set out to describe the fact that this is an immense diplomatic task to get somewhere. But the main point I was trying to make in remarks, my remarks, was this has got to be a different kind of diplomacy. If it were me, I would know I can't do this by myself. I've got to have Raymond, or I've got to have you, or I've got to have Sidrell, or I've got to have some real scientists with me all the way, leading. Because if I'm going to negotiate something, I better know what I'm doing, technically, and I don't. So somebody's got to be there. So I think this process has to involve an interaction of scientists and diplomats or whatever. All of them got to be able to work in tandem in a good, comfortable way. And I must say, from the experience of working on this issue, of course, I'm used to scientists. I like scientists. They're interesting people. They're always inventing things, and it's fun. But this all got started with a conversation between my wonderful friend Sidrell. And so it's, that's in the nature of this case. It's just got to be a collaborative enterprise right all the way through.
Just to build on that, there are many decisions that the U.S. government confronts today in many fields could benefit from scientific input. And there are relatively few resources within the U.S. government, certainly on Capitol Hill and in the executive branch, for policymakers to turn to for scientific advice. For instance, there's a very few number of members of Congress with a science background, and most of them are medical doctors. So I think there's a message here, too, to scientists, primarily young scientists, to think about roles in public policy. Because whether you look at the environment or this field or stem cell research or whatever, many of the issues that we're dealing with as a society today have a scientific component, and we don't make good decisions if we don't have the scientific knowledge available to us. I'm going to ask some questions now coming from the audience, and let me just work through some of these. They're on a variety of different aspects. There are several groups working towards a nuclear-free world, including the Four Horsemen, Tony Blair, even the Episcopal Church. Is anyone coordinating these groups? Is there communication among the groups?
Let me try that. I'm the president of the Plowshares Fund, which is a San Francisco-based philanthropic global security foundation. And we fund many of these efforts, including the Federation of American Scientists.
Thank you very much.
Is that why I was invited? One of the things we do as a foundation is not just give these groups money, which is the most important thing, but we also try to help them network together to link up their efforts so that the Federation of American Scientists knows what the Union of Concerned Scientists is doing, knows what the Methodists for Peace are doing, knows what the Council on Foreign Relations is doing. And this whole field is remarkably netted together. There are all kinds of conferences, networks, email lists, and organizations that are coordinating this. There isn't one uber organization that is directing everything. This is America. People don't like that. But there is a tremendous synergy that's going on where these efforts are being done in parallel, complementary. It's frankly not good enough yet. It's not good enough yet, but you can feel the momentum building. People sense the importance of this moment. They know that these kinds of moments don't come very often, where you really get a shot at fundamentally changing a major policy of the most powerful country in the world. And they feel that this year and the next couple of years are such a moment. And so you see increased enthusiasm for making the most of it, giving it all our all to make the kind of fundamental shift Secretary Shultz would like us to make.
Any other comments about coordination or even division of labor among the various groups working in this area?
There's the foundations do serve that function well. It's not, I mean, Plowshares does a good job of that, but there are other, you know, we're funded, for example, by MacArthur, and MacArthur has organized, gets everybody that they're funding to talk to each other. I'd just like to say that perhaps unfortunately, it's not a large community. I mean, it isn't as though there are millions of people working on this. There are perhaps hundreds. It's a small community. We tend to all know each other. It's something that can happen very naturally and organically, that you tend to know the colleagues and who works. And, you know, I'm a scientist and trained as a physicist, and so I tend to try to focus on those things where I can provide some kind of scientific and technical input. But I go and listen to what's, you know, let other people define, you know, where can I contribute that? But it takes place, as Joe says, there's not a director that's pushing this, but it's a small enough community that everyone talks.
Other comments?
I think there's a lot of support. It's been kind of an interesting thing, this evolution. Because Sid and I started with this idea of having a conference on the 20th anniversary of Reykjavik. So we organized, but we didn't have any money to put on a conference. It cost money to put on a conference. And we didn't have any. And so we wheedled John Raisi and the director of the Hoover Institution to put up a little money, and it really wasn't very much. And finally we conned him into giving a little more. And finally we had enough to put on the conference. And then we published this article. And the MacArthur Foundation got in touch, said, "This is interesting. Do you need any money? We'll give you some money." So they gave us some money. Then Sid, he likes to play the violin. He's good at it. He has a little quartet he enjoys playing with. And one is Paul Brest, who's the director of the Hewlett Foundation. And the other two members are Wally Hewlett and his wife. So they're playing the violin, and they're asking Sid about this, and he's telling them, and by the time their little quartet playing is over, he's got some money from the Hewlett Foundation. So I don't say it's that easy, and you have to, but I think that if we have something worthwhile to do, we can get funds. People are looking to support something that's really good and solid, and you're not wasting the money. You're using it carefully and effectively. So I think it's there.
How about the public? We're in a time of decreased ability of the media to cover serious issues, or decreased tendency to cover serious issues. Is public support necessary for this to come about? And if so, how do you envision public support?
Well, obviously, it's necessary, and a president will want to generate that. And I would think before he goes up and makes some big speech to a joint session of Congress or something, he'll want to do his homework pretty carefully so he knows that he's got support. Because you don't want to make some big announcement and there's half the people are applauding, the other half are sitting on their hands. You want everybody up applauding. So you've got to do that. But at least from our little work on this, we've been approached by all sorts of groups, and we've held meetings with them. I think you've come to some of them. And people get enthusiastic, and they have said, I don't want to name them because it'd be not for me to say what they're doing, but very important groups that can generate huge public support are saying, how do we work? And we've been saying to them, well, get your act in order. And when the time comes, we'll tell you when to pull the trigger, so to speak, and express that support and let the president know on a nonpartisan basis. Religious groups, other kinds of groups can make a huge difference here.
Yeah. This is actually a very popular issue in the American
public.
There's
a book that's going to come out. I don't know whether it's probably hasn't been announced, so I shouldn't be too specific about it from the publisher's standpoint. But there has been some really good, careful research on Ronald Reagan and the evolution of his views about nuclear weapons. And it's a wonderful book. I've been reading it. They asked me to write a foreword, which I've done. And this is going to appear probably sometime early next year. And I think the time of it will be good because I think particularly you have to work on conservatives to get on board here. And Ronald Reagan's their idol. They see this book, they're going to see that this man was working on this, thinking about it, convinced about it, long before he was president.
Mm-hmm.
Very deep. And nobody can brush him off as some no-nonsense and the liberal. He's a guy that's respected, and it's going to be laid out in his own words, not somebody writing, I understand he thinks this or that. There's going to be a lot of quotations of things he said and did. For example, there's a long takeout, close as I was to it, and the many times I went to talk to the Pope about what we were doing in the Reagan period. We kept the Pope totally posted everything in advance, he knew. And, of course, we worked on Poland with him. But Ronald Reagan was in contact with the Pope before he was president, and there was a little interplay there. So this is going to come out. I think we have a lot of stuff to build on if we do it right and pay attention and keep our eye on the ball.
Here's a question that drills down on that one just a little bit. In a country where many believe everyone should carry a firearm, how do you convince the public that nukes are not a weapon we need to keep ready in our arsenal?
Maybe I could take that on. Actually, we, the U.S., have made similar decisions in the past. And as you know, under President Nixon, for example, biological weapons were taken out of our arsenal, ruled. We embraced the concept of biological and, of course, chemical weapons as well as being illegal internationally. And so you might ask, well, how does that decision come about? It's a combination of leadership. It's also a recognition that either that military weapon is actually not so useful militarily, or in a balance, in an analysis of the balance of benefits and costs, one may decide that the liabilities and the costs are greater than the benefits. So these are all matters that enter in, and they are a combination of technical factors, but also I'll call them moral and political factors, because we all recognize that what we do defines for the rest of the world and for ourselves who we are. Right? And so, in fact, this is not something that we are shy about doing when the incentive is there, and we have done it before. And if it is possible to do with nuclear weapons, which we still don't really understand if it is or how it is, then that's something that the United States has shown before that we are in principle able to do.
Yes, sir.
I think that we should also add that this is not part of the motivation for this is that nuclear weapons are just becoming increasingly irrelevant for military uses. There is broad political support for gun ownership in the United States, but even most gun owners don't want their neighbors to own flamethrowers and bazookas and things. This isn't a part of disarming America and making America weaker. This is a part of an international program that will, in fact, make America more secure.
So how about the India nuclear deal? How does that fit into the direction you feel we should be going?
You may get some division on the panel here. I am strongly opposed to the deal that this administration has made with India, which overturns almost 40 years of restrictions on India. It was actually an arrangement that was created by Henry Kissinger and President Nixon, where we banned the export of nuclear technology to countries that had not signed up to the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty and were not part of global efforts to reduce and restrict nuclear weapons. We're now saying to India, you can keep your nuclear weapons, you don't have to sign the treaty, and we will still sell you nuclear materials and will encourage others to as well. I think this deals a body blow to the nonproliferation regime. I'm still hopeful that the Congress will not pass this deal in the next couple of days. But there's a lot of business and a lot of money lined up in favor of the deal, so it's a real uphill fight.
Others?
We worked very hard against the deal. We have Federation of American Scientists is endorsed. We have a list of 68 Nobel Prize winners that are on our board of sponsors, and we got almost half of them to sign a letter to congressional leadership opposing the first deal. And I have very good friends who are very, very smart who come out on the other side of this. And in general, what happens, at least in Washington, is that there are people who are paying, that they recognize there's a trade-off, that there's benefit to be better relations with India, and this is sort of the price for it, and there's a risk to the nonproliferation regime. And they weigh that, and if you sort of sit in a nonproliferation chair the way I do, you think the India deal is bad. And if you sit in an India chair, then you will tend to think that the deal is a good thing. And I think that one of the things that we have to make clear is that I think the current administration did not see it as a trade-off because they want to have better relations with India. They want to have a strategic relationship with India. This was a price that the Indians put on with cooperation with the U.S. But the administration is not concerned about the proliferation dangers. They have said that they would like to see they will welcome having a stronger India because they're looking as a long-term balance against Chinese nuclear power. And I think that this is a path that is fraught with peril, and we will come to regret in the long term. Now, it's true that because of this peculiar timing situation that China got recognized as a nuclear power and India didn't, and this, you know, the Indians resent that, as they probably should, because the overall trade in the Non-Proliferation Treaty, we divided the world in these nuclear haves and have-nots. The have-nots were going to stay have-nots, but because the nuclear haves were going to agree to get rid of their nuclear weapons. And so this division of the world in the have and have-nots was going to be temporary until everybody became a have-not. Well, the nuclear powers reneged on their part of the deal. And so that is why we're in this situation today that India is not recognized and China is. And now I suspect the former Secretary of State will have a comment on why.
Mr. Secretary.
I have my reservations about the deal as well, but let me put it as I see it. how one talks about it. I don't think it's a matter of wanting better relations with India. I think it's a matter of trying to pull India into the nuclear pattern more. And to us, and they didn't come anywhere near all the way in. Maybe we should have driven a tougher bargain. But they've come a step, which is important, and they're coming in the right direction. My own sense of it is that if we can get this program off the ground that we're talking about here, then a lot of things will be falling into place in a different way, including the India thing. Over 20 years ago, Rajiv Gandhi went to the United Nations and gave a passionate speech, you should get it and read it, about the importance of getting rid of nuclear weapons. It's a beautiful speech. And it was called to my attention by chance as I was working on this, the first article, and getting it up. And for the Indian finance minister, somebody I'd known, Chittabaram, and he came and called on me down at Hoover. And we talked about economics for a while. And he said, what are you doing? And I told him about this. And he said, well, oh, we are the initiators of this. Rajiv Gandhi, a long time ago, spoke about it. I said, well, what about now? He said, still our policy. That's where we stand. If the world will go this way, we'll go this way. So I made a point of putting a quote from Rajiv Gandhi in the original Wall Street Journal article. Mm. And boy, did I hear from Indians. Yeah. They are so glad to see that in there. So I think there is a balancing act here, and at least I would see the argument in favor of the Indian treaty as they're making a step. Now, I'd feel a lot more comfortable if the president were actively pushing our nuclear free world agenda, and we could start to wrap it into that, because you want to have the Indians fully engaged. Obviously, you want them here, so you want them part of the act.
Dr. Smith,
I think you have just been treated to three of the most perceptive statements on the contentious India deal that I've had the pleasure of hearing or even reading. I want to go back to what Joe Cirincione said, that the India deal will be a body blow to the non-proliferation world, and I think he's specifically referring to the non-proliferation treaty. And yet I think out of the three comments that I've just heard, one can put together a synthesis, which is optimistic, but I don't think it's wildly optimistic. The NPT, the non-proliferation treaty, is wildly out of whack. The nuclear powers have not lived up to what they agreed with. There are now some have-nots that actually have nuclear weapons and yet are not part of the acknowledged five. It strongly suggests what, again, Stanford has been pushing through Jim Goodby, Ambassador Goodby, that it is really time to rewrite the non-proliferation treaty. And this time, the nuclear powers, probably newly defined, will have to agree to a date certain when they're going to bring their arsenals down to such and such levels, as opposed to the more vague conditions of the present treaty. In other words, there's a synthesis coming out of this in India deal that could lead to a very hopeful conclusion, namely a new and better, more up-to-date, enforceable, verifiable NPT. So I'm not as I'm not as pessimistic as the India deal as I thought I would be as I first began to read it. And I repeat, what you have just heard, I think, has been a very balanced and incisive description. Good question, Gloria.
Joe, did you?
No, I think we're on to something here. And the only way to repair the damage that I see from the India deal is to change the game, is to do what Secretary Shultz and Dr. Smith have just said. You've got to create a new paradigm, a new structure that can scoop India and the other countries that have not signed the treaty, Israel and Pakistan, into that world where we're all marching together towards the reduction and eventual elimination of nuclear weapons. And then the India deal becomes, and the exemption that's just been built into the system becomes less and less important, because we're building a brand new system.
So here's a long agenda. We're going to renegotiate the NPT. We're going to ratify the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty. I'm just talking about the U.S. agenda here in terms of policy leadership. We're going to do a follow-on agreement to START II and so on. And I just recently looked up the State Department staffing in the area of arms control and disarmament. First of all, it was a relatively small group at the assistant secretary level, although I think it's being elevated to an undersecretary level. There seemed to be a lot of political appointees in that group, not a lot of people I saw who had a background in the field. I really didn't recognize any of the names, and I looked at the biographies to see where the folks had come from, and they had come from other departments or prior service or law firms or had been contributors or whatever. So that's a long way of getting around to this question. How do we do this in the U.S. government? I mean, essentially, the infrastructure for doing all of these things is relatively thin at this point. The questioner asks, what are the chances of resurrecting the U.S. Arms Control and Disarmament Agency, having someone in the audience had served at ACTA in the past? But I broaden that question to, how do we organize ourselves in the U.S. government to follow up on all of these great ideas?
Let me amend what I said, and I think we all said, about what's the first thing the president should do. Because I think the first thing in the transition, particularly a president should do, is don't bother me about issues. I don't want to think about them. I just want to think about personnel. And I want to get my administration staffed, not just the cabinet people, but the deputies and the undersecretaries and the assistant secretaries and so on. I want the most competent people I can find. And I don't give a damn whether they're Republicans or Democrats or what they are. I want competent people. And I'm going to go out and get them. And that's my priority. And once I've got myself an administration full of competent, energetic, knowledgeable people, then I'm going to be able to deal with these issues. So I think you've got to put people first. Now, you mentioned the State Department, which I once was secretary, so I know about it a little bit. It's in bad shape. During the Clinton administration, for many years, they didn't even take new classes into the Foreign Service. And you know, if you're running a big organization and don't bring young people in at the bottom all the time, you're going to have big holes. So that's where they are. In the meantime, it's a system, kind of a two-career system, where you bring in people, you can get real good people to come in. And you train them and you give them experiences, you try them out, you figure out who's good, and they get gradually sorted out. And then they get up into their late 40s, early 50s, they become an ambassador somewhere, at which point they're out. It's ridiculous. At that point, they're at the height of their capabilities. And the U.S. government system then casts them out. If you're running a company, you do that, and they get those people to get into it, you say, now is the time I'm really going to get the mileage out of this person. So I think we got to bring new people in energetically, and then we ought to reach out and try to, I can name you, dozens of Foreign Service officers who've left recently, first-class people. These people are on top of their game. And try to get them back in some fashion. And then you've got to make top-quality so-called political appointees who are there because they care. I think when I was secretary, I had John Whitehead. He had just retired as head of Goldman Sachs, so there's a guy who knows his way around the world, and he knew a lot of this stuff. I had Paul Nitze, an icon in this field, and I said to Paul, I didn't know a lot about the nuclear weapons when I became secretary. I said to Paul, you're going to be my tutor, and I'm going to learn, and you're going to teach me, and they'll have a regular program, and I'm going to wind up knowing a lot about this thanks to you. And I had a whole bunch of other people, any one of whom I could send somewhere. I could say, you know, something's wrong in Germany, Paul. Go over and kick the tires. Find out what's really bothering them, and let's get it straightened out. And Paul goes over there. Everybody wants to talk to Paul Nitzsche, not just because he's representing the U.S., but because they know him. They know you don't have to explain it to him twice. He'll get it. And they know when he comes home, everybody will want to know what he says. And you got to have people like that. And you got to have a lot of them if you're going to mount the kind of effort that we have to be able to make. So I think your point, whether there is a new agency or this or that, frankly, I think one of the problems, you alluded to it, since the Cold War, the nuclear subject has kind of fallen off the table, and people aren't paying attention. And one of the things I think at least we've accomplished is we've got to back up to people's attention where it belongs. And talk about this renewing this START agreement that's going to expire in December 2009, if that doesn't get renewed, it's a catastrophe. And people are working on it. Who's working on it? Some deputy assistant secretary somewhere. That's not the way to get these things. That's big time. The president needs to be talking about it with his counterpart, and the Secretary of State needs to be charged with doing it, and he needs to be doing it in tandem with the... You got to get it up at that level. And then you'll get somewhere. You can't delegate these things to... And that means there has to be a priority. But I think... Carrying on too long, I know. That's I think that if we can get this nuclear initiative off the ground and make it a global enterprise, not a U.S. thing that we try to get people to sign up to, but a real global enterprise where everybody, the Indians, others, are in the effort with us, that it could have a transforming effect on the whole international atmosphere. And people could see, you know, it's possible for the leaders in this world to take on an important issue and do something about it. And all of a sudden, that would make climate change look a lot easier, or whatever else we're working on look a lot easier. It would change the whole atmosphere. There'd be a lot of side benefits. So, as you can see, I just wish I were a little younger. I'd go in and say, Mr. President, I volunteer. I'm going to run this thing.
You may get your chance. Back to your point early on about bipartisanship, to be very fair, the fact that there isn't a strong cadre of people pursuing this within the State Department isn't entirely the fault of the Secretary of State or anyone in the executive branch. We have this phenomenon in the U.S. where an administration comes in, and particularly in the early days, many positions at the just sub-cabinet level are not filled for months or years at a time, and that really has to do with partisan squabbling, often, between congressional committees and an administration. And it's a structural problem, a political problem, that I don't think is very functional for the United States. And I think in the interests of getting things accomplished, we need to look to remedying that type of partisans fighting that goes on that handicaps our government.
It's not just partisan. There is in the process of trying to recruit somebody immediately distrust. There's kind of an attitude, if you're willing to serve in the government, there must be something wrong with you. And we are going to raise heaven and earth to find out what it is. And if somewhere back when you were an infant you did something wrong, we're going to publicize it to beat hell. And we're going to make it as difficult and unpleasant and obnoxious as we possibly can for you to serve. And that's nutty. People want to serve, at least in my experience. And you can find, you do a run through FBI records and the IRS records, and you find out most of things that you need to know. And then you say to somebody, you know, you get into these jobs and you're in the spotlight, So if you've got any big, terrible closet, skeleton in your closet, let us know and let's get it out of the way. And maybe you shouldn't serve or whatever. But it's not so. We're making it a very difficult process. Just the clearance process itself takes months. And when Condi Rice, for instance, when she changed from being the National Security Advisor in the White House to being Secretary of State, there was a whole new clearance process. And the FBI comes around and they ask me all these questions about... I say, this is the craziest thing I ever heard of. It's nonsense what we've gotten ourselves into in this country. This isn't partisanship. It's not Republicans. It's just a process that's gotten out of control.
It's a sclerotic process, and it's the president who can drive it in a different direction.
Well, I don't know. I think there's people, both candidates talk about reaching across the aisle and so on, and I hope, for goodness, they can do it. And they can, on this process, clearance process, bring people in and say, all right, we've got to get the government staff, right? And we want the best people we can get, and that's what I'm going to try to do. And let's have an agreement on how we're going to go about this and get people cleared and confirmed and in the job quickly.
Different aspect of this. Question from the audience asks Dr. Smith, you've suggested a plenipotentiary with power to negotiate with other countries. How will the American political system allow such a negotiation? Should there be a non-proliferation czar or a nuclear reduction czar?
Well, in the first place, despite the kind words I've said about Russia today, I do not believe in czars for Russia, and I don't believe in czars in our government. What I found is that every time a czar is appointed, he is given the power to, quote, coordinate, end quote. And coordination can only be done with, quote, budgetary control, end quote. So that if a czar is to be created, and I don't think that's the right way to go, then surely that czar has got to be given absolute ham-fisted control of the budgets of those items of government that he is trying to control. I think I'll stop there, Gloria, and let someone else handle that hot potato.
Any other comments about plenipotentiary? Or?
There's been talk that if Senator Obama's president, he would appoint a deputy national security advisor to be in charge of preventing nuclear terrorism. And I'm in favor of that. Senator Clinton made the same proposal. Governor Romney made the same proposal during the campaign. So this is not nonproliferation. This is not the whole thing. It's just focusing on organizing, funding, and accelerating our programs to secure and eliminate the materials that terrorists could get to make the next 9/11 a nuclear 9/11. I think that does require a central authority, and I'd be in favor of that
centralization. I have a very different view.
Sir.
Out of my experience. I think in any organization, when you want action, you have a line organization and you want the line organization to do it. What's the line organization? The line organization are the people who are nominated by the president, confirmed by the Senate, responsible to the Senate to be called up and testify. This is your line organization. The Defense Department, that's part of the line organization. The State Department, the other departments. And it's tempting always to say, well, we'll get somebody in the White House. What is somebody in the White House? That's a person that's appointed, no responsibility to the Senate. You're not confirmed. Don't have to go up and testify. Look at what's happening. Can't get these people to testify. They're not responsible people. I mean, I don't put it that way. But you, whether you're running a company or whether you're running a government agency or whatever it is, you want the people who are the responsible people to be in charge. And if the issue is important, that's where it belongs, right up at the top.
So in the Department of
And the person who should be coordinating this is the President of the United States. And he should have it as something that he worries about. And obviously you have a White House staff that do things, but your main people are the main people. Well, personally, I think that there ought to be a different conception about how the executive branch operates than it's fallen into very White House-centric operation. And that's not a good way to go. And yet it happens because you go into the cabinet, you go to your department, and before long, the only time you go to the White House is a cabinet meeting. It's a show and tell. Doesn't mean anything. And you lose that contact. And I think the cabinet ought to be organized into groupings by subjects. There should be some office space over in the now called the Eisenhower Building right next to the White House. Encourage them to come over and meet, and let them meet in groups with the president. Encourage them to have lunch in the White House mess more. In other words, keep the cabinet attached to the guy who got elected, who's the person in charge. And don't try to run things by people who aren't presidential appointees confirmed by the Senate and responsible people. I was burned. I'm very burned. I was so burned by the Iran-Contra business because that was a rogue operation out of the White House with some CIA support. We found out about it. We objected to it. But it was something operated by people who weren't nominated by the president, weren't confirmed by the Senate, weren't responsible to go up and testify. And you don't want them running rogue operations. You want it to be done in the proper, I think, proper line authority way.
So if you thought that we needed to centralize control over the programs to reduce and eliminate loose nukes, would you favor doing that with someone in the Department of Energy, someone in the Department of Defense, an assistant secretary, for example, put them in charge?
I would put it somewhere in those. I don't know where I would put it, but that could be discussed. And if I were president, I would say, well, all right, I'm making you, the Secretary of Defense, responsible for that. And I'm saying to you, the Secretary of State, you, the Secretary of Energy, work with this person. And to say, you, the Secretary, task these people,
yes,
because these departments have capabilities that you don't have. And then I want to have a report about how this is going.
Yes.
And I don't want to just hear from you about it. I want to hear from the people that you're working with about it. And so that's how I'm going to do this task. But there's some other task. I'm going to say, okay, you're the Secretary of State. You're in charge.
Yes.
And you have to work with Ann Sohn. You pass the ball around. And and then these departments have vast resources.
Yes.
And they're the places that can do something.
And budget authority.
And they have budget, and they can go and ask for budget. And then the Congress says, why do you need that budget? And you explain why you need the budget. And so this is all part of the democratic communication process. And the people in the press watching this, and they're reporting. And whereas you get a little group in the White House squirreled away and nobody knows who they are, and they're doing all kinds of things. There's no press, there's no Congress, there's no nothing. It's you're asking for trouble.
Okay, that's the second really good idea I've gotten out of this panel today.
I feel strongly about this.
And actually, they're not mutually exclusive, because what you want from your NSC staffers is coordination, conflict resolution, and holding the lines of responsibility tight to the cabinet departments who are in charge and responsible for executing the policies. So really you need both to be strong doing what each can do, but not with the NSC folks trying to execute policy.
But it's also true. And you look, I suspect if you went into the minutes of NSC meetings over the years, you would be surprised to see how, almost without exception, who is the person that makes the decision? The president. And the president's got to figure out where his priorities are and pay attention to things. And in the end, you want it to be the president's decision because he's the guy that got elected. And he's the guy that, by getting elected, he's shown that he knows how to mobilize support. So when it's the president's decision, I know when I was Secretary of State, people would say to me, well, what's your foreign policy? I said, I don't have one. The president's got one. And my job is to help him formulate it and carry it out, but I don't have a foreign policy. The president has a foreign policy. You don't have a defense policy. The president has one. You don't have a get rid of nuclear weapons policy. The president's got one. And this is how you get things done, I think.
We are getting towards the end of our time together, so time maybe to explore one more topic. Of course, concerns about climate change and energy prices are driving a resurgence of interest in nuclear power. So let's talk about the nuclear power proliferation connection for a moment. There are a couple of questions from the audience that I'll start us off with. Can we afford not to reprocess reactor fuel? Is there any solution to the problem of nuclear waste disposition? Related questions, but obviously related to the proliferation of advanced fuel cycle facilities and thereby paths towards proliferation. Anyone want to take that?
Let me give a partial answer or summarize a few key points. There's been reference made to internationalization of the fuel cycle, and it really is a cycle. There's one part of it which has to do with the creation of the nuclear materials, the enriched uranium, or in the case of reprocessing of plutonium. There's the back end of the cycle, so-called, which is what do you do with the waste afterwards, and they're both intimately connected. We often read these days about the first part, the enrichment, the concerns because of what that might imply for capabilities of countries or what they might do with that technology. But in fact, the backside, the waste side, is also extremely problematic, not just in the U.S., but internationally. There are grave concerns about sustainably handling waste. There a number of technical options, but there are no easy solutions. In particular, these are not only technical issues, but also highly political issues, as we know. I'd like to comment that a solution that comes about has to be one that's by consensus in the international community. And we've already had reference to the haves and have-nots under the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. It's essential, if there's going to be a sustainable, stable situation in the future, that it be one that everyone, essentially everyone, buys into. You can't just have the haves dictating to the have-nots what's going to happen. Remarkably, even though in recent years, we, the United States, the then president of Russia, also the head of the International Atomic Energy Agency, each have very sincerely proposed various ideas, concepts for an internationalized fuel cycle, there's not yet a consensus that's emerged, and more than that, very few have even asked the client nations. Many of the have-nots that would have to abide by such a system, what they think about this. We in the technical community are beginning now, or have been beginning in the past year or two, to actually talk with our partners around the world, especially at the technical level, and asking, what do you actually need? Because no matter what, at the end of the day, no matter what we, the United States, or Russia, China, the major nuclear powers, or the international bodies like the United Nations and the IAEA, no matter what we think, unless we're responsive to the needs, and these are both technical but also political needs, perceptions of, if you want, the customers, if I can put it that way, this is not going to go anywhere. It's not going to be sustainable. I actually do have hope now that we've started seeing the engagement of our colleagues around the world. Again, at the technical level, we see a lot of opportunities for forward progress. It's going to be a lot of hard work. People have to keep their sleeves rolled up. But we do see real opportunities for forward progress if we have this kind of engagement of all of the interested parties, and we've seen that happening.
Harold?
Dr. Gianlow has summarized the top issues very accurately. I hope everyone was listening. It was very well done. The next tier down is what to do about the waste. Dr. Gianlow has discussed that that is the more serious part of the front-back internationalized technology. Economically, one could simply let the used fuel, having been through the reactors once, just sit in a pool and be guarded carefully, nation by nation by nation. That, I think, is the best economic route. But there is that problem of waste and the radioactivity of the waste. And I don't propose that I have the answer, nor do I think that Yucca Mountain is anything close to an answer. But I would bring to your attention how the French have gone about it. The French are, I think, our most advanced nuclear nation, with 80% of their electricity generated by nuclear power. The French do separate the spent fuel. They do extract the plutonium, and they do sell it to various nations, such as Japan. And, of course, they store it in well-guarded facilities. That gets the plutonium perhaps in good shape, at least is the way the French do it. They take then the highly radioactive waste and they vitrify it. They put it in glass. And rather than making the statement that we will store this now vitrified, highly radioactive glass for the next 20,000 years anywhere, they simply put that waste, which isn't all that big. It's the beauty of nuclear power, lots of power out of very small amounts of mass. But they store it very shallowly buried, and they promise to keep their eye on it for the next 10, 100, one presumes 1,000 years, because they know, as I think we all know, we don't yet have a publicly accepted way of storing the waste from nuclear power. But we need nuclear power for the reasons that Dr. Duffy gave. So I think as we go down, we, the world, go down this path, we'll have to look very carefully to see how the French solved the problem in their own country. Admittedly, a much more centrally directed country than ours. But nonetheless, they may have the clue on what to do with the next tier of problems after we deal with Dr. Gianlow's first tier.
Other comments?
We've done a lot of work on a particular proposal by the United States government called GNEP, the Global Nuclear Energy Partnership, which involves a proposal to begin after a 30-year hiatus to separate plutonium from used fuel. And we're making the argument that this might eventually be a good idea. But economically, it just doesn't cut it right now, because even with if we hypothesize a rapid buildup in nuclear power plants, if you look at the world reserves of cheap uranium, where cheap is defined as cheaper than getting the plutonium out of the used fuel, we have enough uranium to take us through to about 2070 at the very minimum. It's true the French now separate out plutonium. They do this in a system that's heavily subsidized by the government. But what we should not ignore is that they have an inventory now of over 80 tons of separated plutonium. They're getting plutonium out faster than they can burn it up in their current reactors. These schemes only make sense if we have what are so-called fast neutron reactors that can burn the plutonium, and we don't have any of those that are currently available commercially. We've built lots of them. They go back to the beginning of the nuclear age, but we've never successfully commercialized. And when I say we, I don't mean the United States, I mean human beings on planet Earth. The British have another program where they have done the same thing, where they were going to build these fast reactors. The fast reactor program was canceled, and through just a breathtaking example of the momentum of bureaucracies, they went ahead with the separation program, and now the British have 100 tons of separated plutonium. So I think that, moreover, the American proposal is to burn up the plutonium in burner reactors, whereas most people who look forward to see nuclear power in, say, the year 2100 imagine that we will have a plutonium-based economy, if to the extent we have nuclear power plants. and they will be breeder reactors burning plutonium. And so the last thing we should be doing today is be burning those that seed fuel today so that in the year 2100, when we want these breeder reactors, we don't have any plutonium to fuel them. So whether it's a good idea or not, I'm not certain, but I'm absolutely certain that it's not going to be a good idea for the next half century.
Well, what isn't a good idea is for the plutonium to fall into the hands of somebody who might want to make a bomb out of it. That's the
right, and that's
rub it, of it all.
What
is.
We do now, essentially, we leave the plutonium in the fuel rods. They're sealed up in what are called, they're put into cooling ponds for several years. Then the cooling ponds get full. They were supposed to go to Yucca Mountain, and that hasn't quite worked out the way they planned. And so now, typically, they're put in these giant steel and concrete cylinders called dry casks and stored there. So they're in these highly radioactive fuel rods that are what the International Atomic Energy Agency calls self-protecting, which means that they're so radioactive that if you and your friends go and try to steal one, by the time you get to your white panel van, you're dead from the radioactivity. So it's that's one of the good things about stealing stuff that's really, really radioactive. It tends to kill the thieves. So it is a little bit of self-protection there. That's much better than having the separated out plutonium, where now instead of a one-ton fuel rod, I need to steal 8 kilograms of plutonium that is not particularly radioactive. Very different kind of problem.
This is a complex problem, and one of the major issues in the expansion of nuclear power is that the decision-making is so much more diffused mm-hmm. when it comes to the civilian nuclear power industry than is decision-making on nuclear weapons. And so to ensure that appropriate concerns about proliferation, nuclear terrorism, and so on are incorporated in that decision-making is a big challenge. That's too much to get into right now. What I will close by saying is that the next president of the United States will face major challenges in the area of nuclear security, nuclear terrorism, and non-proliferation and arms control. Where the next president will have an advantage is the amount of strategic thinking that has gone on, particularly through the work of Secretary Shultz and his colleagues, but really through everyone here at the table, all of the organizations that Plowshares is funding, and so on. So there's a base on which a next president can build some very good advice and directions ahead that have been laid out. So with that, I'm going to end our discussion today, co-sponsored by the Federation of American Scientists and the Commonwealth Club, called Paths to Zero, and thank our panelists for the day. Ivan Olich of the Federation of American Scientists, former Secretary of State George Shultz, Raymond Gionlo of the University of California, Joe Cirincione, President of Plowshares Fund, and Dr. Harold Smith of the Goldman School of Public Policy at the University of California, Berkeley. Thanks to all of you for being with us, and this meeting is now adjourned. Thank you. It was great. Thank you.